Blog Talk Radio.
Hello? Yes.
Can you hear me? Brian?
That we are... It appears we're having a little technical difficulty, but I'm going to go right on. We're live now. My apologies to the audience. There appears to be a little bit too much network traffic, but I'd like to welcome you to Perkins Platform Radio this afternoon. We have two wonderful guests with us, Dr. Yvette Jackson and Dr. Veronica McDermott. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
We have quite a bit planned for today, and with only 30 minutes, we just want to jump right in. And first, I'd like to introduce the audience. First, I'm going to talk a little bit with Dr. Jackson about her first book on this topic, as I understand it, The Pedagogy of Confidence, Inspiring High Intellectual Performance in Urban Schools. We're going to talk a little bit about that, and then we're going to ask Veronica to jump in at any point she feels like it. Dr. McDermott is a co-author with Dr. Jackson on another book published by ASCD called Aimed High, Achieve More: How to Transform Urban Schools Through Fearless Leadership. For those of you who are just joining us for the first time on Perkins Platform, this is a show dedicated to issues and topics in educational leadership. And we've had a number of guests who have talked about different topics, and this one certainly getting a lot more attention. And so I would like to just, again, welcome both of you. Thank you for your patience dealing with the technology. But jumping right into what is this theory and practice you have, Yvette, about expectations and high intellectual performance in urban schools? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it all came about when I decided to look at what is it that we do for students who are labeled as gifted that we really should be doing for all children. In other words, we know when students are provided with enrichment, when they're given invitations to really explore their intelligence, when they are given the kind of opportunities that allow them to make vast applications, they are engaged, they're motivated, and they think longer and better. And I was thinking about that when I used to be a teacher, and I would say, why isn't this what the platform should be for all children? So I started investigating those factors on both a cognitive and more recently on a neuroscience basis, and found that the kinds of educational activities, strategies that we do for those students are exactly what also stimulates neural connections and makes thinking more effective. So my premise was what we've been doing all these years for students whom we call school-dependent students. These are the students who really more need the enrichment even more. We've been doing the exact opposite. We've been focusing on the deficits to the point that we don't even look for the possibilities of strengths. So now the through the pedagogy of confidence and the work that we're doing through the National Urban Alliance, we go in with an asset-based approach, which is all about starting with a student's strength to not only engage them, but to really move and build on the skills that might be underdeveloped.
Excellent. Thank you. You know, one of the after reading a little bit more about your work and thinking about a lot of what this translates into in terms of expectations, what has been your experience, though, in urban centers? When we talk about intellectual development, what's been your experience among teachers and administrators? Is this something that's second nature, or is it really something that you have to work at to get people to understand it?
Well, you know, there are two different camps out there. In other words, there are teachers who have believed in this forever, and that's a large number of teachers, but they have been forced to be part of policies that tell them not to focus on strengths, but to, in fact, data mine to death where students are weak. Now, those are teachers who are going into their classrooms, though, and say, I don't care what these policies are saying. I know what's good to really elicit and connect to students. Then there are the other ones who have been so beaten down by that same kind of premise about deficits that they don't even try that anymore. They've just kind of, I won't say they bought into, but they're going along with this focus on weaknesses. So when we come in now and say we're going to take the whole first month of school just to have you identify where your students are strong, we have had the most unbelievable reactions where teachers are saying they feel alive again, that they feel rekindled, because by focusing on student strengths, first of all, the students see that you believe that they have strengths. So the relationships between teachers and students are shifting. Then when students do start exhibiting what it is that they feel that they are strong at, the teachers are saying, you know something, when I go into school every day now, I can work with this. I can work from an area where students can move even more quickly because I'm starting from where they're strong. However, the kind of practices that really enable this kind of philosophy to transfer into instruction does need some refocusing and looking at the kind of strategies and practices. Again, not that are not out there. They are out there, but again, they are the kind of strategies that have been put in the closet because remediation had played such a strong part of the agenda. However, we're changing that agenda, and we're getting, as I said before, really remarkable responses from students, teachers, and administrators.
Which brings us to the other point of all of this, which is that this kind of work is really, in essence, a reconceptualizing or a taking back of the narrative of what urban students are capable of doing and what they're capable of achieving under the right set of circumstances. And what we've discovered in our work, which will not come as a surprise to anyone who's ever worked in a school, which is that there are powerful influences, cultural school influences, that really shape the beliefs, the practices, the structures, and obviously that has a tremendous impact on the outcomes. So, in essence, Yvette's brilliant work on the pedagogy of confidence really set the theoretical foundations, the principles upon which we hook our work. But the second book was an attempt to say, how do you actually get there? What can you, well, once you believe this, and I have yet to find anyone who's read Yvette's first book, The Pedagogy of Confidence, to say, we don't believe this. Her arguments are compelling. It's all so obvious. You almost want to say, why didn't I see that before? But then the next question is, how do I get there? How can I move my school? How can we move our school so that we can actually elicit those high intellectual performances and change the life trajectory of students who otherwise would be buried under an education that does nothing to really lift them up to where they can be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I understand. You know, the audience, again, if you're just now tuning in, this is the Perkins platform on Blog Talk Radio. We have a dial-in number that in the last 10 minutes or so, I encourage our listeners to call in. The number for call-in is 347-826-9029. Again, 347-826-9029. Well, Veronica, you make some really good points about the administrators and the teachers and others who have read Pedagogy of Confidence, and so they believe that this is really important, and they believe in the theories and a lot of the strategy. I want to shift a minute, and we'll come back to that, but I want you to think about it. And tell me your reaction to the rest of kind of the universe that's out there working against the individuals who are trying to have high expectations. And then you have policies that are in place that actually work against that. That, for example, I posted this week about an article in the New York Times newspaper, and the title is Schools Act, Gifted or Just Well Prepared. You know, there are exams that are given throughout the country for people to get into these gifted and talented programs, or they call them TAG programs, talented and gifted programs. And so what they found, at least in New York City, that these special programs for intellectually gifted have really turned into places where those who can afford preparation for their children, they're the ones that get in. Tell me the relationship between talented and gifted education and what you are talking about here with high intellectual expectations for children. First, let me hear a little bit about that, and then I want to hear you respond to what I started with, which was the factors that are working against that.
Oh, okay. Well, what's really interesting is even the way that title of the New York Times was constructed, because what we're saying is so many students who do have the opportunity of being well-prepared, they are gifted, and we use the word gifted with a hyphen, you know, G-I-F-T hyphen E-T, meaning they are given those experiences and those preparations that allow them to achieve. And then when we've gone back and looked historically at the students or people who have wound up being labeled as, let's say, truly gifted, let's say somebody like Albert Einstein, they weren't doing so great in everything that they did in school. But what happened was they had the exposure and the support to identify what he, let's say Einstein in this case, was really interested in, and then got the, again, more support to pursue that interest. That's very different than what is happening, though, in terms of the way students are being labeled in school. So in other words, they're looking at calling gifted students who may just be topping out on achievement tests. But there are several factors here. First of all, the factor that an achievement test, reading and math scores, do not show the span of one's potential at all. They show how well they're doing at this particular snapshot in time, but it does not show how well they're going to apply that understanding into innovative kind of experiences that will wind up later allowing them to excel in their lives. And so what we're saying is, it's one, those experiences, again, that allow students to be gifted, how do we put them into the school system so that everybody can benefit? Now, the kind of repercussions, I will tell you, we have gotten repercussions of those from some parents who will say, well, wait a minute, if you're calling all students as being capable of getting these extra experiences, you're going to maybe be taking away from our children what has what we have thought was going to be specialized. And that's been a debate. And so what we've had to do is say, well, wait a minute. If everybody is getting the same high-level kind of exposures, then everybody thinks higher, and you can differentiate better and even see where those children who are already labeled could be excelling in different kinds of areas. But that has been a point of contention in some areas. But we're not turning around from this theory. If the real purpose of education is to have everybody have their potential drawn out, then we already know what that means in terms of what they should be provided with.
And it's no surprise that there would be parents who would be spending additional funds to prepare their children to be gifted. It just goes to show you that even
right.
the whole notion of what giftedness is is suspect. I mean, there are many people who echo the sentiment that all people are gifted in certain things at certain times. It really is a matter of your particular interest and how much time you spend in it. And actually, the other issue, which Yvette alluded to, is the notion of what do we really mean by giftedness?
Right.
How do we define that? But if you get back to this notion of certain kids having the benefit of receiving many more gifts than other students, that's clearly the case in what's been happening in public education, especially recently, that there are certain schools that are totally under-resourced and there are others that are getting lots and lots of quote-unquote gifts. And our interest lies in how do you level that playing field and how do you disrupt the narrative that the students who currently are not labeled as gifted and who currently are not receiving all of those gifts, how do you disrupt that narrative to in fact prove that these kids are as capable and have as much potential as anybody else? But because of the way society has structured things, they haven't been given the same advantages.
Sure. And we heard at least part of this theory years ago with Howard Gardner's multiple intelligence quiz and countless other both psychiatrists and psychologists who have referred to what you said, Yvette, that in some areas individuals are gifted and have very different talents. So I think that's a very important point for us. What exactly... If in a particular school, does a principal have to deal with in implementing some of these programs? Are you finding that it's a hard sell? Because I know that there are some places where parents are very competitive, and they actually don't want a lot of children to benefit from whether it's enrichment or other programs. I want my kid in TAG.
Right.
I want my kid to be in the gifted program, and they actually retreat from some of the schools when the opportunity expands. And so, what are the principals up against when they encounter this?
Well, I'd like to answer the first part of that and let Veronica finish because she's doing so much work around the principles and how to cultivate this theory. But one of the things I want to bring up is in, very, very high economic areas, let's say like a place like Scarsdale, New York, where the people pay a lot of taxes to live in those areas, and they don't have any programs labeled as gifted programs because the thought there is you live in this district because you want to make sure that everybody is getting these advantages, and that's why you pay those big taxes. It's in other areas where there may be some consideration about, well, maybe if we only have X amount of money in this budget, we should only budget so much for students to have these kind of exceptional gifts being given to them to cultivate that. But Veronica, you want to talk about in terms of the principal's role and what they deal with?
Right. I mean, I think the leadership role varies depending upon where you're actually situated and what the context is in which you're working. So, for instance, when we walk into a district that I am going to euphemistically call urban, real inner city, where every school within arm's reach is pretty much facing the same issues. What we find is that people resonate immediately to the notion that we can do better, we want to do better, and we're going to go out there and we're going to start the work. Now, that takes a certain amount of courage, and it certainly is a battle that that people engage in willingly because they really believe in what's going on, and you know they have other issues that they're facing in order to get to where they want to go. What's in my mind a little bit different, still requires courage, is when you have, let's say, a suburban school district that has a mixed population, so which frequently happens in urban districts, where you will suburban districts rather, where you'll have one corner of the suburban district houses the wealthier students, the students who are coming from families that have many, many more resources, and you might have one or two buildings that have quote unquote those kids, the students who are struggling with the ravages of poverty or whatever the issues happen to be. Now, there you have a different set of circumstances because now you might have a principal who's got a building that has traditionally been looked on as less than, if you will, and you frequently have a board of education that unfortunately does not represent the population that the building principal is dealing with. Or you can have a superintendent of a district like that who sees the inequity and then is faced with the issue of how do I do right by everyone, which is a very, very tall order. The first characteristic, obviously, is that you need a tremendous amount of courage. And we talk a lot about the fact that to be a leader, you need to have a moral compass. And once you've made up your mind about what's best for kids, then you have to move into the notion of being the architect, the one who's going to set into motion this vision. But I love the image of an architect because architects are people who have lots and lots of skills, but they never, ever, ever work in isolation. They have other people who are the electrical engineers and, you know, people who are the mechanical engineers. You can't build a phenomenal structure on the basis of one person. So for us, that means that you need to have a team. You need to have a support mechanism for their expertise and also for their the way that you can all support each other because it gets very lonely out there. And we know of stories that have ended well, where people had the fortitude to keep along the fight and managed to succeed. And there are other stories where the forces that be crushed the initiative, which is something that you have to go into this work with your eyes wide open, knowing what you're facing. And so the other ways that that we look at leadership, leadership in a situation like this has to be multidimensional. It has to be something that is, as I said, built with a team. But we also talk about the fact that not only are leaders in these situations architects starting the thing in motion, they also have to be visionaries. So they have to be, we call them soul friends, muses, that they are in fact able to function as a muse, to rev up people's spirits and say, we can be better, we can do better, and we're going to do it together. They also have to be extremely intuitive and know where they can go to move people to another level of practice or to move people to another way of thinking. They have to be the kinds of people that build relationships. And we refer to that particular aspect of leadership as being a soul friend, someone who knows you even better than you know yourself. And I think if we're all honest, we know that there's been someone in our life who kind of said, I believe in you, and this is what I see in you, and you sat there and said, oh, no, and found out, yes, they were right. And then finally, you have to be a minister, and that, in fact, is the root of the word administration, is to administer. And what we mean by that, a minister, is to be a go-between, to bring the resources together, to kind of act as the clearinghouse, if you will, getting to people what they need so that they, in fact, can do their job. And when those things are working in concert, it becomes a powerful force that can counteract the other things that are happening in the life of a school, and people begin to believe differently about themselves, differently about the students that they're working with, differently about the community that they're working with. And
right.
Also invite the community into this because, I mean, the school is theirs. It's not ours. We don't own the school.
Right. And I mean, you just mentioned one of the basic premises of leadership, particularly school leadership, is that you can't do it all by yourself.
Right.
And as I really think about this work, where as we are talking about specifically high expectations and the expectations for intellectual development in our schools, you usually don't hear those.
Exactly. Well, you know what?
So,
I was going to say what has happened is the term literacy has become a new word for remediation. That, you know, for those schools that are in urban areas, just as long as you're focused on literacy and you reached AYP, you know, annual yearly, that's good enough. But in schools that are in neighborhoods that are very affluent, they would never accept that as being the ultimate of where you want to take the children. It is about intellectual development. And so we push that terminology so people will consider that this is about the gray matter. This is about the fact that all people are endowed with enormous intellectual capacity. And we have not been focusing on intellectual development. We've been focusing on reading and writing, nice tools, but not the expansiveness in terms of what we need to push for if students are going to be self-directed and self-actualized.
And I couldn't agree more with that. And as we expand our conversation about what intellectual means, and I think I'm going to have to invite you both back later on in the year because I really have been spending a lot of time trying to grapple with this notion of expectation, but then how you get other people to accept that as the norm and not that you're doing something that is spectacular when you say that I believe that not just that all children can learn, but I think the key is in what you said, that they have tremendous capacity. And
right.
So the challenge is pulling that out of individuals. And I appreciate what you're saying here. I know that we only have just a few more minutes, but what I do want to mention to you is that I've seen a lot of situations where principals have met their downfall. Even superintendents.
I think
you have to be strategic in your message, and I'm hearing also from you, you have to be strategic in the way you approach this. You have to be deliberate, and this is not something you can do kind of accidentally, that it requires development as well. And don't make the assumption that everyone around you is on the same page with regard to this. Because I'm convinced that there's some people that have low expectations for children and don't know that those really are low expectations.
Right.
Absolutely.
They honestly don't know it. And so
right.
to assume that everyone knows what high expectations, or even this, again, this notion of intellectual development, you might think that that means putting together the words intellectual, I know what that means, and development, I know what that means, and so I can put a formula together to make that happen. No, And I think the work that the two of you have been doing through organizations like the National Urban Alliance goes quite a long way to push districts and superintendents and board members and principals alike to understand and recognize that this needs to be developed. So I really appreciate all that you've had to say today. And, again, I'm going to have to invite you back to the audience. We appreciate your patience in the beginning with the technology and invite you to come back actually on Friday of this week. You'll have a special broadcast of the Los Angeles Unified School District. We have a number of guests that are going to be at the American Association of School Administrators Conference, going to join me in a broadcast about school turnaround efforts in Los Angeles, policy and practice. And so we ask you to join us. That show is going to be this Friday, February 22nd at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time. We're going to have a great conversation, just as the one you've just enjoyed. And so, again, to my guests, Dr. Yvette Jackson, Dr. Veronica McDermott, thank you for all the work you're doing. And really I applaud you and encourage you to keep up the good work with these individuals. And don't give up.
thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for disseminating.
Yes, your message is really an important one. And so, until next time, to the guests, go well, stay well.
Thank you.
Thank you.